Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Cochran, Judge Siegel, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, and please be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for this January 8th panel in the new year, 2020, believe it or not. Remember when you were kids and you thought the year 2000 was way off into the future? 2020 is something they talk about in Star Trek. You know, this is not, that can't be a real date. But here we are. We have six cases on our calendar today, three of which are set for oral argument and three for non-oral. The first case is State of Minnesota versus Dominic Wright. Counsel, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments with an additional five to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. The timing restrictions are indicated in the light and clock in the podium, which, by the way, you should know, I'm sure, by now that you can raise or lower to your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep track of the argument in the audio recording of today's hearing. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Dominic Wright. This court must reverse Mr. Wright's conviction because of several violations of his constitutional right to counsel. Specifically, Mr. Wright was denied counsel at a critical stage of the proceeding, and his subsequent waiver of his right to counsel was involuntary. It was involuntary because it was premised upon the district court's erroneous refusal to even consider appointing new counsel, and the district court's erroneous information to Mr. Wright that it could not appoint new counsel and it would refuse to delve into the problems between Mr. Wright and his assigned attorney. As far as the critical stage goes, this was the first day of trial, scheduled day of trial, and a request for a continuance of the trial date. Those are both critical stages of the proceedings because they are adversarial in nature, because critical rights may be lost if not exercised at them, and because the right to counsel had, of course, attached. It had attached way back when, at Mr. Wright's first court appearance when counsel was appointed. And I think it's important to know what actually happened here. From what we can tell from the record, and to the extent it's sparse because the district court refused to inquire further. Mr. Wright told his attorney he needed a continuance of the trial date. Mr. Wright was under the impression that his attorney would ask for that continuance. And instead, what happened is the parties went into court, and Mr. Wright's attorney, Mr. Leary, unexpectedly said, "Your Honor, Mr. Wright will address the court for that request."
Well, it's pretty clear from the record that request, that discussion about a continuance was there's enough in the record, I think, to discern that the desire to continue the case was first raised in the hallway right before that hearing. Is that your understanding of the record, too?
That's what Mr. Leary says the next day, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. So here's my question. It's an interesting circumstance here. It looks from the record to me that counsel did indicate to the court that there's a request for a continuance, but then presented Mr. Wright to provide the basis for it. How is that different from a situation you're very familiar with on appeal, mm-hmm. which is a critical stage, mm-hmm. where a lawyer finds out from his client that the client has an argument that the lawyer might not believe there's a good faith basis to provide a support.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a pro se brief that's filed. Is the filing of a pro se supplemental brief instead of the lawyer actually marshaling the argument ineffective assistance of counsel?
No, I don't think it is, Your Honor, for a couple different reasons. First of all, again, the claim here is not necessarily ineffective assistance. It's the complete denial of counsel. But number two...
Well, yeah, is that denial of counsel?
No, I don't think it is, because on appeal, we have a structured system a fairly unique one in the country, I think, to allow for pro se supplemental briefs. There is a rule that both counsel and the client can look at. There are a set of case law to describe what issues may be raised in a counseled brief and what issues may be raised in a non-counseled brief. And the court, as far as I understand it, treats both of those briefs the same, because the rule requires the court to do so. There's nothing like that here. There's no provision in a trial for the lawyer to say, well, I'm just going to turn this part of the trial over to the defendant. There's certainly no provision in a trial for that to happen. What the word Mr. Wright keeps using is misled, for that to happen unexpectedly, for the lawyer to apparently at least indicate to the client that, sure, we'll make a request for a continuance, and then just completely abandon the client and force the client to make that request himself.
Well, the lawyer had just heard about the continuance request, and let me lay out the circumstances here. It seems pretty clear that you've got a very straightforward trial, at least the lawyer sees it that way. There's a possession of a weapon, and the client springs on the lawyer right before the trial. There may be some new evidence out there, and I got the impression that the lawyer didn't see that there was a good faith argument to support a motion to continue, given the circumstances where the judge had already said, we're not going to do any continuances here unless there's an absolute emergency. And now you've got this last minute day of trial. Mm-hmm. Hey, let's have a continuance so I can go find some evidence. So if the lawyer doesn't believe that there's a good faith argument, what is the lawyer supposed to do in that circumstance? Are you suggesting the lawyer has to forward an argument that the lawyer doesn't believe there's a good faith basis to assert?
I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor. And I want to start with the assumption that the lawyer didn't think there was a good faith basis for the motion. We don't know that. Mr. Leary never says that. Mr. Leary never says, I'm ready to go, Your Honor. I'm ready to proceed, Your Honor, but my client wants a continuance. So we have no idea what Mr. Leary's view of the motion was. If he thought there was no viable good faith basis for the request for a continuance, then his duty is to tell his client that. He does not have to forward that motion. And he can say to the client, I'm not making that motion. We're not making that motion. We're going to trial today. And then we can get to a point where the client can decide, well, this is so important to me that I'm going to hire a new lawyer, or I'm going to waive counsel, or whatever. Mr. Leary doesn't have to do anything. What Mr. Leary cannot do is suggest a motion and then abandon the client to make the motion on the client's own behalf.
Is there a case law that supports that conclusion?
Well, there's no case law. There's no case law on this particular issue at all. I've never seen that.
Again, this is on the assumption that there's nothing in the record to suggest that this was a good faith, that there's a good faith argument that could support the motion based upon what was presented by the client.
It's true that we have no idea what evidence the client, Mr. Wright, wanted to obtain, because he really wasn't given a chance to explain that, nor should he have had to explain that. I mean, he has a lawyer standing there ready to represent him, or supposedly representing him, and it is the job of the attorney to zealously advocate the client's position. If the attorney is being asked to do something unethical, then of course the attorney doesn't have to do that. Of course the attorney doesn't have to make a motion with no factual support.
That a denial of counsel versus ineffective assistance of counsel? I know you aren't arguing ineffective assistance mm-hmm. of counsel directly, but it seems to me what you're really saying is that his counsel was ineffective because he, instead of zealously advocating for his client, told the court that his client wanted to request a continuance.
Because, Your Honor, the difference is between, you know, one and zero. If Mr. Leary got up and said, Your Honor, my client wants a continuance, I'm asking the court on our behalf for a continuance, period. Then at least he would have made the motion. And I can complain about how he made the motion or how he supported the motion, but he would have represented his client in making the motion.
Isn't that what happened?
He didn't do that at all.
I thought when he said that, I thought the court treated it as a motion and denied it as a motion.
The court treated it as a motion from Mr. Wright, not necessarily from Mr. Leary on Mr. Wright's behalf. What Mr. Leary said is,
so there's no prejudice to your client.
My client has asked me to ask the court for a motion, and I'm going to let him explain that.
But if the court treated whatever happened as a motion, how is your client prejudiced by at least that part of it, not the argument part, but just bringing the motion.
Because if he is denied his right to counsel, there is no prejudice inquiry. So it doesn't matter if the court would have or would not have granted the motion. If he's denied his right to counsel at a critical stage, that's a structural error, and the state agrees with that. And there is no prejudice.
I derailed you. You were answering Judge Cochran's question.
That's okay. I admit there's a bit of a fine there's a bit of a fine line here between making the motion, not making the motion. What I would suggest is this. Think about it this way. If counsel called a witness at a trial, and then counsel said, Your Honor, I'm going to let my client examine this witness. And the client, especially without consulting with the client, without telling the client this is what was going to happen, he just looked at the client and said, I don't know, you wanted to call this guy, you ask him the questions. I think we would all say, wait, what is that? You can't do that. That's not what a lawyer is for. That's not why you obtain a lawyer to represent you in a proceeding. The lawyer is supposed to do the examination. The lawyer is supposed to make the argument. The lawyer is supposed to make the motion. Well, that's what happened here.
Not quite, because there's always the opportunity for cross-examination, and the assumption is that cross-examination is going to occur. But there's not the assumption that a motion for continuance to go find new evidence is going to be asserted on the day of trial in the context of a case in which the district court has said, I'm not going to entertain that motion, already informed the parties that there needs to be some sort of an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And the day of trial, after months of potential preparation, the party saying, I think I'd like to go get evidence now, is a motion that it's pretty clear the district court's not going to entertain that motion, regardless of the argument that's presented.
Well, I mean, you don't know, because you don't know what the evidence is. And you don't know when the evidence was became available, and you don't know when the client learned of the evidence. And we have no idea, because Mr. Leary didn't present any of it. And so I think it's, again, we don't have to show prejudice here if we have a violation of the right to counsel. But yeah, I can envision scenarios where somebody just called Mr. Wright. I'm making this up. Somebody just called Mr. Wright and said, that was my gun in the car. Test it. My DNA will be on it. You had no idea that that it was there. Bring me in. I'll testify. That just happened the day before. Who knows? Maybe the district court denies the motion. Maybe it doesn't. But at least the motion gets made and argued. We have no idea, because Mr. Leary wouldn't make any of it. I do want to turn to the second problem here, because the problem here is broader than just that one particular thing. When Mr. Wright comes in the next day and says he's not satisfied with my representation, the district court makes two really critical and big errors that corrupt the entire thing. First, it tells him that it can't appoint a new lawyer. Completely defers to the public defender's office. That's been error for decades, at least since 1991, probably before that. And district court judges keep doing it over and over and over again. Every time somebody comes in a public defender case and says they want a new lawyer, the first thing the district court judge says is, that's out of my hands, you gotta talk to the public defender's office. And this court has said, I don't know how many times, 40, I think I counted the cases, the unpublished ones, that's error. Say it again, because it is. Now, in almost all of those cases, it's deemed harmless or something for one reason or another. Here, it's not, because of two things. One, the district court, in addition to falsely telling Mr. Wright can't appoint a new lawyer, refuses completely to inquire into any problems between Mr. Wright and his attorney. That often doesn't happen. Usually judges will engage in some sort of back and forth with the defendant or the lawyer to try to get to some, you know, resolution of what's going on here. This judge repeatedly and emphatically says she doesn't do that, she won't do it, it doesn't matter what Mr. Wright tells her, she's not doing it. Number two, it results in Mr. Wright waiving his right to counsel, which takes this case out of a whole bunch of other ones where what often happens in this situation is the defendant essentially gives up and acquiesces, and the lawyer ends up representing the defendant at trial, and everything's basically fine. And when the case comes to this court ends up saying, well, I don't know, this probably wasn't quite the right way to handle this, but everything ends up being fine. Mr. Wright isn't presented with that option, because he's so dissatisfied with Mr. Leary, who, by the way, in addition to whatever happened the day before when he tricked him into arguing his own motion, hadn't filed a witness list, Therefore, can't call any witnesses. Therefore, can't even recall the state's witness.
I saw your other argument about alternative perpetrator notice.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct? That's a bit of a stretch, isn't it? I mean, you're saying that the alternative perpetrator defense has to be noticed in a gun possession case?
The
defendant can't say, you know what, this wasn't my gun. In fact, I'll tell you whose gun it was.
Your Honor, look at the transcript for day two of the trial. That is precisely what the trial judge tells Mr. Wright. That is precisely the prosecutor's argument and what the judge says. The judge says to Mr. Wright, you can't testify that that's someone else's gun.
That's not accurate, though.
That's what the judge tells Mr. Wright.
Would you agree with me that's not...
I do agree with you that's not accurate, but I don't think that's the point in this case. Because if Mr. Leary had been in that position, presumably the judge would have told him the same thing. Or at least would have said, even if it's not accurate to say you can't testify it's someone else's gun, what the judge later then says is something like, well, what you really can't do is name the person whose gun it is. Because that's the prosecutor's argument. Prosecutor at trial says he can't do any of this because he didn't file the notice. Well, that's Mr. Leary who didn't file the notice. Mr. Leary doesn't file a witness list, so he can't
call...
Back
to the witness list. Can you remind me, is there any indication in the record as to why Mr. Leary's counsel did not file a witness list?
No, there's not. And the reason there's no indication in that record, Your Honor, is because the district court refuses to inquire into this matter at all. Doesn't ask Mr. Leary what we're... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Before you... I'm sorry to interject, but we're running low on time.
Sure.
So, Mr. Wright does have the opportunity to confer with the public defender supervisor, who then advises him on and puts in the record for waiver of counsel. So how does that impact your argument, that he did have the opportunity to confer with another and, in fact, a supervisor in the public defender's office?
Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I respond to Judge Siegel?
May.
Thank you. Your Honor, it doesn't affect it hardly at all. Our argument here is not, first of all, the consultation was limited to the idea that Mr. Wright has the right to be represented by Mr. Leary, and he was giving up that right. There's no question that that was true. He filled out a petition and he signed it. That's not the problem with the waiver is not in the details of what he knew and what he didn't know. The problem with the waiver is the voluntariness of it, that when a person is given the Hobson's choice between unprepared counsel and no counsel, that's not a voluntary choice. Choosing one of those things over the other is not a voluntary choice, and that's what the federal cases cited in our brief stand for, the proposition that in this situation, the problem is that the waiver of counsel is involuntary, and as a result, the conviction has to be reversed.
Although you're out of time, I want to make sure that all the questions of the panel have been asked.
Can I just ask one follow-up?
Yes.
I assume one of the cases you're referring to is the Gilbert case, Gilbert v. Lockhart. And
yes.
In that case, the court focused on that Gilbert was offered the Hobbesian choice of proceeding to trial with unprepared counsel or no counsel at all. And then the court said this fact, coupled with the fact that the state court failed to specifically advise him of the perils of proceeding pro se, convinces us that Gilbert's constitutional right to counsel was violated. Mm-hmm. So do we have that same situation here? In other words, the district court did give him an opportunity to confer with the public defender's office about proceeding pro se. He filled out the pro se form.
I suppose there's a factual difference there, yes. And he filled out the form with the supervisor's, I guess, aid. But I would say that the gravamen of the situation is still the same. That when you have the right to counsel, and again, we don't have any inquiry. Back up a little bit. If there are exceptional circumstances present, and exceptional circumstances aren't that exceptional, they're circumstances that affect counsel's ability or competence to represent a client. If those circumstances are present, in Minnesota, the district court judge must, that's the word used by the Supreme Court, must appoint substitute counsel. We have no idea if exceptional circumstances here are present because the district court refused to inquire into whether exceptional circumstances are present. Instead, it forced Mr. Wright to make this choice. And so that combination of things is what makes the waiver here involuntary, even if it's slightly factually different from the involuntary waiver in the case Your Honor was referencing.
Thank you.
Thank you. You will have
5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the state, or may it please the court, excuse me, counsel.
Presumably Your Honor, it will please the state.
Presumably what I would say would
everything else is in doubt.
Right. Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawana, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state. I would agree with what Judge Ross started out with, talking about how here it's kind of an ethical quandary, and this is an instance where Mr. Leary has been told in the hallway, we can presume from the record that does exist at this point, that there's a conversation that's had in the hallway about a need for more evidence, and so then he goes into the courtroom, brings up the continuance, and allows perhaps isn't the right word, make sure that his client is heard. His client obviously wants to address the court, obviously wants a continuance because he wants more evidence. The fact that Mr. Leary facilitates him explaining the reason is not enough to show that he's deprived of counsel. And I should clarify, my brief is not very clear. This is completely a critical stage. I don't know what tangent I was going down. This is the first day of trial. This is a critical stage. I'm not challenging that. So here we have a situation where it's pretrial motions are set to be heard. This is the second trial setting. And Mr. Leary probably rightfully doesn't think that there's a need for a continuance. This is a straightforward case. The individual stopped speeding in Minneapolis, going 84 in a 55 mile an hour zone. He has an arrest warrant, so then he's arrested, the vehicle seized, an inventory search is done, and a gun is found.
What if the new evidence is DNA on the gun that associates the gun with someone else?
Well, that evidence actually Mr. Leary already had. The first continuance was granted in October. My notes are for October 9th. They requested a continuance for DNA, and it's not part of the appellate record, but my presumption is that Mr. Butler does have access to what was disclosed. If I'm wrong on that, I apologize. The DNA results were turned over prior to trial, and there was a mixed combination of DNA.
We don't know that in the record.
Then that is something that Mr. Leary knew, which would be why Mr. Leary, he would have had that information.
How do we know that Mr. Leary knew that from the record?
There's no allegation of a discovery violation. There is a continuance request on October 9th, 2018, and before trial, I guess it's our internal records that state that.
Well, how do we know? I mean, your internal records are wonderful, but for appeal, we have to base our decision on what's in the record. How do we know from the record that the ball was simply not dropped by defense counsel or by the state or by someone, and that that the evidence wasn't obtained and that the evidence might be exculpatory if obtained?
On this record, Your Honor, there isn't anything that specifically says that. There is the fact that the state did not call a DNA individual to testify, which would be indicative, and an inference can be made that there isn't a good result for the state with regard to DNA. However, there is also an issue here where the record could have been developed a little bit more with regard to Mr. Leary's thought process. This seems to me akin to an ineffective assistance of counsel claim disguised as a denial of counsel. Had there been a post-conviction filing with an ineffective assistance, Mr. Leary could have testified as to why he did not request a continuance, as to what evidence his client told him he was seeking.
Were you able to locate any cases in Minnesota or the country without regard to the issue that was presented on appeal, where the circumstances were as they are here, where a lawyer stands before the court and says, my client wants a continuance, and then turns the presentation of the argument over to the defendant himself?
I'm not aware of one that is identical or similar facts. However,
do you agree with Mr. Butler that this is an anomalous circumstance?
Yes and no. I would agree that this is anomalous in the way that it's been presented, but this is something that happens at the district court all the time.
What is?
Where an individual wants to make a request that the attorney doesn't feel that they have a good faith basis to do. That's why there's the ethical
obligation. How do we know that the attorney does not feel that there is a good faith basis to assert the argument?
We don't specifically know that, Your Honor, but we can read that in by looking at the record.
What in the record would inform us that Mr. Wright's counsel considered the request and believed that there wasn't a sufficient good faith argument to be presented?
We can look at hit on the transcript page 2, where the appellant's attorney says that, and this is on page 4 of my brief if it's helpful, stated that appellant had asked him to ask for a continuance, and I will let him address the court directly as to the basis of that. That is not saying I don't agree with him. That's not saying anything, but there's an inference to be made. This is not, as Mr. Butler said.
Why isn't the inference? I haven't done my homework. Maybe he's right.
Because counsel is presumed to be effective, and this, again, this is not an ineffective claim, but I think some of the logic with that does help and is of some assistance to the court there. This, because this is not an individual who's a brand new attorney, this is someone who's been a public defender in the office for more than 25 years, there are often instances where there's conflicts between a defendant and his or her representation, and that's indicative and seen in some of the cases for the second issue where there's, I believe Gillum is a case that's cited where they're discussing, the attorney says that there's a breakdown between communication, it's seen in the record, the court still denies substitute of counsel and says, look, you may not like everything that your attorney says to you. He may not be kind to you. He may not say things that you want to hear, but that doesn't mean that he's not representing your interests. Well, he has a role to play.
Well, let's turn there, because I think that's, I'm not speaking for the court, just for myself. I'll tell you that the bigger problem I have with the state's position is on that second issue here. Would you agree that under Lamar, the district court's indication that Mr. Wright could not have a different public defender is erroneous?
I agree that it's erroneous, but here I think it is harmless because of the fact that there were not exceptional circumstances.
How would we possibly reach the conclusion that there were not exceptional circumstances when the district court followed up by saying, essentially, I'm not going to delve into the reasons. I'm not going to delve into any conversation or basis for understanding why it is you want to get rid of your counsel.
Because you still have to look at the totality of the circumstances. This is coming the day after a continuance request was made on the basis of a need for new evidence. Now the defendant is saying, well, actually, I don't agree with my counsel, and I want a new attorney. It's an attempt to get another continuance. So it's,
how do we know that, though? Because from the record, it appears that the request for the continuance was brought up late, and so how do we know that this is really just an attempt by him to get another continuance? In other words, his desire to seek more evidence that wasn't discussed until, you know, just before the trial. And so how do we know this was really about him wanting more time as opposed to wanting a new attorney?
I think it's correct, Your Honor, that there isn't an explicit explanation from him or from his attorney, or there isn't a direct inquiry from the district court asking, well, why is it that you need this continuance the day before that leads to more with the evidence? So we're stuck with the record that we have.
Are we stuck with the record because the district court erred?
I don't think that it was enough of an error to require reversal here. Because,
well, the question is, was it an error, not whether there's enough to require reversal?
There was an error in telling the appellant that he could not have a different public defender.
Okay, and was there also an error in not inquiring further as to the basis?
Not here, because he did not establish exceptional circumstances. Because
was it error to say, I don't get involved when he asked, don't I have a right to effective counsel or something like that? And the court said, yes, but I don't make the decision or determination whether or not you have one.
I don't think that's error. I think that's correct that the court doesn't inquire into the exchanges between the attorney and his or her client. They may inquire if they see something that's troubling or if something specific is brought up. But there have been cases by this court, in fact.
Well, wait a minute. Before you leave there, what about following Judge Cochran's question, what about the district court's statement that it's essentially, it's not my job to determine whether there's effective assistance between you and your counsel. Is that error?
I don't think that's what the court is saying. I think that the court...
Assume that we interpret that.
Okay.
Would that be error?
Yes. The problem with interpreting it as that, the state's position would be that it can't be looked at in a vacuum. This is a circumstance where this individual has been represented from May by this attorney all the way until the second trial setting in January. This is the first it's come up.
Why would that matter if it was only the day before this exchange that the client first became troubled? Let's assume there was a basis for the client being legitimately troubled with his lawyer's competence. Why would it matter that occurred the day before trial or the 3 months before trial?
Well, under State v. Worthy, there's questions with regard to whether it's an untimely request for a substitute counsel.
But if the knowledge of the lack of competence, assuming that there was a lack mm-hmm. of competence and that was a reasonable concern, if the client, if the defendant only became aware of that the day before, then you, I assume you would acknowledge that that changes the timeliness part of the equation, doesn't it?
I don't think it completely changes it. If he becomes aware of it the day before and that's his reason for it, then there needs to be more of an articulation on his part. And I get the argument of chicken before the egg and how this is difficult to explain more and to tell the judge more when the judge isn't asking questions. But it's not as if the judge cut him off and said, you're done, you're not talking anymore. He could have explained more. He actually also met with Emmett Donnelly, the supervisor for Mr. Leary, and spoke with him and talked to him.
About waiver,
but we also don't know the full extent of that conversation. This is a circumstance where we
Again, isn't that a problem for the state and not the defendant? We don't know because there was not a searching inquiry. Isn't that the reason we don't know?
We don't know because there's not a searching inquiry, but also because at some point he decides that he's fine representing himself and moving forward without. And he makes that after speaking with counsel, who doesn't raise any issues. If Mr. Donnelly had any concerns about the representation, he would be bound by the ethics of the court and as an officer of the court to bring that up with the court.
What does the record tell us about the reason there was no witness list provided by counsel?
There's nothing in the record with regard to that. It is common for a defense to only cross-examine the state's witnesses. It is not necessarily in this case. I'm hard-pressed to find what witnesses could have testified as to a car that the defendant rented, that he was driving, speeding in, and then there's a gun in the center console. I'm hard-pressed to see what alternative perpetrator there could have been.
Is it the reason we're all hard-pressed? Because there wasn't a discussion?
There isn't one that appears on the record.
Isn't that the only place we look?
Yes, that is, Your Honor. And I'm not trying to be flip about that. What would have been helpful, I think, would have been a post-conviction proceeding where we could have called Mr. Leary. Mr. Donnelly could have also testified to this to flush it out.
That's if the argument was ineffective assistance of counsel based upon the performance of counsel.
Yes.
That's not the argument that's being
That's
made.
Not, but it, that's basically what the argument is, just disguised as a denial of counsel. Because here, the complaint, if you look at the reply brief, it's listing the problems that are seen with Mr. Leary's performance. That has nothing to do with denial of counsel. That's a strategic decision.
Was the state correct, the prosecutor correct, and the district court correct in limiting the testimony about somebody else possessing the gun based upon the alternative perpetrator doctrine?
No, the way that it comes out is it's I'm forgetting the page number of the transcript, but the court says you can't just say that somebody else had the gun and is trying to, I think, refer to the fact that the alternative perpetrator, there's a threshold showing that you have to put the person there and that had not been met. I think that the way that it's explained initially is not helpful, and then the district court does later try to correct the mistake.
By not helpful, you mean wrong?
Yes. It's wrong in the sense that it's conveyed to an individual who's not legally trained, and this is, I understand, part of the problem with this whole circular, we start with the problem with the continuance, and then he doesn't get it, and then he chooses to proceed pro se. But pro se defendants are treated as though they are attorneys for purposes of any filing in this court. And at this stage, he was told of the perils of this. He was told that he may not understand. That's why it's different from the Gilbert case that Judge Cochran cited. It's not the same as a situation where someone is not given the opportunity to know what they are giving up. And he made that decision after reviewing it with another attorney, talking about those things, and then decided to proceed pro se. That was a counsel decision, and the state submits that that was voluntary. This record is not ideal. This record, I think, could be flushed out a lot more, but there have been instances where there have been other statements that district courts have made that this court has still found did not abuse, the district court did not abuse its discretion. For instance, I would turn this court's attention to State v. Gillum, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision, 629 Northwest 2nd, 440, pages 449 to 450, where there are discussions where they're talking about the attorney is yelling at him, and there's instances where there are personal tension, and they still deny the substitute of counsel. And I'm misspeaking. It's not that case in which there is an individual making worse statements. There is an unpublished decision from this court, which I will file a letter of supplemental authority with because I cannot remember the name and I did not cite it in my brief recently, where there was an issue with a district court from Scott County saying things and saying, you do not get to PD shop and you do not get to do this, but also making statements that were erroneous. And this court
Why weren't appellant statements sufficient for to require an inquiry by the court as to whether he had effective assistance of counsel?
Because, Your Honor, it has to be whether or not an attorney cannot effectively represent, and that goes to whether the counsel has the ability or competency to represent the client. That's the exceptional circumstances, and that's what this court looks for. And here, saying that he disagrees with his attorney about getting a continuance and that he wanted to get more evidence.
That's not what he said. He said he was misled by his attorney.
He says he was
misled in the sense that he thought his lawyer was going to come and make an argument for continuance, and instead the lawyer turns it over to him. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened, but that's what he is asserting, and which is different from I'm generally dissatisfied with my lawyer's performance.
I see that my time has expired. May I answer your question?
Please.
Yes, he does say that he misled is the term that he uses. But I think in the context of everything that has happened just the day before and with the district court witnessing Mr. Leary saying, my client would like me to make a motion for a continuance, and then the client speaking, that the court is aware of what's going on, and this is not... It's not a situation where he's saying that his attorney is prohibiting him from doing things or that his attorney is incompetent to represent him or unable to do so. This isn't a conflict of interest similar to State versus Page or any of those cases where they're just like, I can't say anything because my client is going to raise an ineffective assistance claim. That's not what we have, so it wasn't sufficient. The state would respectfully ask that you affirm the conviction, and as I conceded in the brief, the credit for jail time should be awarded.
Are there any other questions by the panel? Thank you for your argument. Counsel for Mr. Wright, rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to clarify a couple things about the record on the second issue.
We all know who you are, but I'm going to make you repeat your name.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. My name is Benjamin Butler, and I represent Mr. Wright.
Thank you.
In response, I think it was a question by Judge Cochran. There was a statement about whether the judge had cut off Mr. Wright or whether the judge had allowed Mr. Wright to say whatever he wanted. The judge did cut Mr. Wright off. All Mr. Wright ever said was, I'm not happy. I'm not ready to proceed with my counsel. I don't have the exact quote. If you look at page A4 of the addendum, I don't wish to proceed with my current representation. The first thing the judge says then is, are you ready to proceed on your own? She doesn't say, tell me why. She doesn't say, what's the problem? She doesn't turn to Mr. Leary and say, sir, do you need more time to talk to your client? She immediately jumps to, well, you're going to have to represent yourself if Mr. Leary's not going to represent you. This idea that Mr. Wright somehow can spout forth a whole bunch of reasons without being in court, in front of a district court judge, without being asked, it doesn't make any sense. It dovetails with another thing that was said, which was, why didn't we have a post-conviction hearing to expand the record? Well, that's not the obligation. It's the district court's obligation to make a searching inquiry into these concerns. Then the district court can weigh the results of that inquiry and decide whether exceptional circumstances exist. What the state wants is for Mr. Wright to show exceptional circumstances just to get a hearing to decide whether there are exceptional circumstances. That doesn't make any sense. You make the allegation, which Mr. Wright did, you make the request, then the obligation is on the judge to make the searching inquiry. If the judge makes the inquiry...
Don't there have to be serious allegations of inadequate representation before the judge is obligated to make the inquiry?
That's the language in the case law, Your Honor. And I guess what I would say is, first of all, a person saying, my attorney yesterday misled me and tricked me into making my own continuance motion is a pretty serious, very specific, as Judge Ross said, very specific allegation. The concern here wasn't just, I'm not getting along with him or he's yelling at me too much. It's my lawyer just tricked me into making a legal motion on my own behalf. So that's a pretty serious allegation. The other thing I would say, Your Honor, is that the trial judge here, Judge Holton Dimmick, again, she's not weighing and evaluating. She doesn't say, you haven't given me enough, Mr. Wright, for me to ask the next set of questions. She just immediately says, well, you're going to have to represent yourself if you're not happy with Mr. Leary. So again, she's not making the inquiry, whatever, whether it's a threshold inquiry or the actual inquiry, the trial judge isn't doing any of that. And that's
Mr. Butler, but the judge does seem to make the predicate finding that this request was not timely. on the morning of trial. So what is your response to that?
My response to that is, to the extent she makes that finding, it's in kind of a monologue with a bunch of other things she says that are wrong, like we had a Rasmussen hearing, which they didn't. The case had been set for trial in November, which it hadn't been. Number two, I think it goes back to what Judge Ross was discussing with counsel, which is the thing that triggered Mr. Wright had just happened. It had just happened the day before. And he comes in the next day and says, this thing, when I was misled by my lawyer, that's sort of the straw that broke the camel's back here. I can point to other things in the record. When Mr. Wright says, I'm getting ineffective assistance of counsel, of course he's not able to explain, because no one asks him, why that is. The record gives us some clues. There's no witness list. There's no alternative perpetrator notice. The Rasmussen hearing that was supposed to happen, it never happened. No one knows why. It wasn't. Now, that's a request that Mr. Leary made. This wasn't something like, oh, Mr. Leary was tricked into making it or forced to. Mr. Leary requested a Rasmussen hearing back in May, and that never happened for reasons that aren't clear from the record. It is transcript page 324, Your Honors, in which the district court tells Mr. Wright towards the end of the trial that because Mr. Leary didn't file an alternative perpetrator notice, Mr. Wright could not testify that, quote, it's my friend's gun, or, quote, that's not my gun. Now, maybe that's wrong. I think that is wrong. But that's not the point. The point is that's how the judge is seeing the case. And that's how the judge sees the case because of what Mr. Leary didn't do. And so the extent Mr. Wright is troubled about this, by this, he has every right to be. And we don't know what else was really going on here because the district court did not make any inquiry. All of this results in a waiver of counsel that is involuntary because Mr. Wright has really no choice and no option. And when that situation, the waiver is involuntary, and when the waiver is involuntary, the conviction must be reversed and the matter remanded for a new trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. Interesting case. I think you're never going to find new circumstances in a situation that's pretty straightforward, but these are certainly new circumstances, as both counsel acknowledged. Thank you for your oral argument, for your written briefing, helping us quite a bit. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you. Matter submitted.